Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into the Dunedin Income Growth Trust. We're going to be looking at the strategy and the objectives of the trust, as well as what the future holds in terms of the outlook and the factors at play. And to do that, I'm very kindly joined today by Rebecca McLean, who is the co-manager of the Dunedin Income Growth Trust. Rebecca, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Hello, Jonathan. Nice to meet you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is a really interesting trust. You know, looking at some of the holdings here, which we're going to get stuck into later on in the podcast, it does provide a very steady income. We're going to be looking at the dividends and what supports those dividends. But before we get into the crux of the conversation today, Rebecca, please could you give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself, but as well as the Dunedin Income Growth Trust, please.
Sure. So Rebecca McLean, I'm an investment director at Aberdeen, and I've been working in UK equities at the firm for a number of years. I have been in the industry for about 14 years, and I co-manage the Dunedin Income Growth Investment Trust. I also co-manage a couple of open-ended UK strategies, UK sustainable and UK ethical equity funds also. And I actually started my career in sustainability. So my first job out of university was a research analyst for a sustainability consultant. And it was through that avenue that I got into asset management and trained to be a fund manager. So a bit of an unusual avenue, sort of route to the role, but I think sort of all useful experience for what I'm doing today.
Thank you. And there's some really deep roots in responsible investing within this trust, which we're going to discuss later on in the podcast. But let's start from the top, if we may, Rebecca, and look at the strategy and the objectives of the trust, please.
Yes. So it's Dunedin Income Growth is one of the oldest investment trusts. And it's got a long heritage. The trust objective is to deliver growth in capital and income. And we do this by investing in UK and European businesses, focusing on high quality companies that we think will offer shareholders the ability to sort of deliver that attractive total return through the cycle and that income. So the trust has got a strong track record of dividend payments. So 43 years of growing or maintaining its dividend, and the dividend yield, which we can come on to talk about, but is at a premium to the market. So it's about 4.8% dividend yield on the share price of the shares. So the dividend is very important, and we think that investing in quality companies that deliver a resilient income is the best way to ensure that we can deliver that income to shareholders and sustainable income to shareholders.
Thank you. So I believe that the trust has a differentiated approach to UK and European equities. What do you mean by that, Rebecca? And what does that mean for the portfolio construction of the trust?
Yeah, there are 5 points of differentiation. I mean, the first is heritage. So as I say, it's one of the oldest investment trusts. But the other points would be there's a focus on total return. So we're not just looking to invest in high yielding businesses. And the reason for this is that, you know, the risk that you take when you're investing in a high yield company is that the risk is that the company doesn't pay that dividend. And we think that a better way to generate a superior return to shareholders to invest in companies which have an attractive total return, so companies which are able to grow their capital and their income. So that would be sort of a key differentiator. The second is active positioning. So it's a concentrated portfolio. There's only 33 holdings, which means that the portfolio is very different from the benchmark. And it's different for a reason. It's because we want to pick our best ideas and have conviction positions in those best ideas that we think have the ability to outperform the index. So it doesn't track the underlying index, which is the FTSE All-Share. So that's an important differentiator. The third is resilient income. And I think if you look across the index in particular, the FTSE All-Share, and you look at those big dividend payers within the index. Actually, they're very, a number of the big dividend payers are very cyclical businesses. So 40% of the dividends that are paid, that were paid last year in the FTSE 100, are from cyclical industries such as banks, oil and gas, and metals and mining. And these companies depend on external factors to be able to pay that dividend. And it means that you do get dividends cut. So if you look at the track record of the dividend payments of those big payers in the FTSE, actually, the majority of them have cut their dividend in the last 15 years. And we want to make sure that we're picking companies that we've got high degree of confidence that that company can pay that dividend. And we're looking for them to be able to fund that dividend through factors that are not dependent on external factors, or there are idiosyncratic reasons for that growth. So we're looking for resilient income. And I think you saw that come true during the COVID year, where the benchmark dividends payments fell by over 30%, but the underlying portfolio dividends for Dunedin Income Growth fell by 10%. So it's much more resilient in terms of those companies that we're selecting. And then finally, sustainability. You know, as you mentioned, we have a sustainable investing approach, which is about reducing exposure to high risk areas, but also looking for opportunities to invest in sustainable businesses. So those are 5 points of differentiation. It means that it's a very selective portfolio with high active share. It means that the portfolio is overweight quality and growth. It's got higher returns than the benchmark, and it's differentiated in its positioning. We're overweight the UK mid-cap sector. We've got 20% allocation to European businesses. So we are looking to be different from benchmark, but we're doing it because we think that that's the best way to perform and generate and achieve that objective, which is to grow capital and income for shareholders.
Thank you. So yeah, sticking on this point of portfolio construction and stock selection, of course, you know, the strategy is there and the objective there is total return. But when you're going out and you're building the portfolio, when you're looking at, you know, the growth and the income, are you taking the same approach to every stock that you're looking for growth and an income from every stock? Or do you have different baskets within the portfolio where, you know, one may be offering higher growth than the other and one may be offering income, or is it you have a pretty standardized stock selection across all of the portfolio?
Yeah, we're looking to target a small premium to the benchmark. So we do want to generate income from the portfolio. I mentioned before the premium yield of the trust on the share price it's higher than the benchmark, and that's because we've got an underlying portfolio which has got a high yield, but we also benefit from option writing, from gearing, and also the discount, because the shares are trading at about an 8% discount to NAV. So you know, we at the moment the shares are offering a premium dividend yield, but on the underlying portfolio we are looking to have a portfolio of companies which has got a broadly in line but slightly higher dividend yield to the benchmark. But the way that we think about that is to really create balance within the portfolio. So as I mentioned, we're looking for quality businesses, and about 70% of the capital is invested in what we would call quality compounders. These are high returning businesses exposed to structural growth trends, strong business models and robust financials, which will allow that company to grow and reinvest in the business and deliver growth in capital and income. And if we take that sort of allocation of 70% of the portfolio, which is in those groups of companies, you know, companies like Unilever, Sage, company like a Softcat, which is a distributor of software and hardware in the UK, and Convatec, which is a healthcare business. Those companies have got a lower aggregate yield than the benchmark, but it's got higher dividend growth. So on a weighted average yield of that part of the portfolio is about 2.7%. So the dividend yield will range sort of up to 4% for those businesses. You do generally get lower yields within that portion of the market, but you get better growth. So the dividend growth expected for those that part of the portfolio is nearly 7%. So that's about 70% of the portfolio. But then we do have an allocation of the portfolio to high yielding businesses. It's about 30% of the portfolio at the moment. And in aggregate in the portfolio, these businesses have got a weighted average dividend yield of 7%. So, you know, at a material premium to the market, but we're expecting lower growth from those businesses. But, you know, we spend a lot of time researching these companies. We want to have a high level of conviction in that those companies can pay that dividend. And as I mentioned before, you know, we don't want to be too overly reliant on external factors, which are outside of the business's control. So companies in this bucket would be companies like Assura, which is a healthcare real estate investment company. So the underlying revenues come from the government, so very secure and defensive, as the underlying businesses are GP practices and primary care practices. So you've got a high degree of confidence that those revenues and earnings will come through, and that that business will be able to pay its dividend. Another company is Chesnara, which is a small cap. It's only for 300 million market cap. It buys closed end life insurance businesses, rolls them up, runs them efficiently, and extracts value. And it has a 20-year track record of growing its dividend. And the dividend yield on those shares are nearly double digits. So, you know, those are the sorts of businesses which are high yield, but we've got more confidence in those companies being able to pay the dividend. I mean, the other one I sort of point to within this bucket, we do own Total, which is the only oil and gas company that we have in the trust. So it helps from a sort of factor risk perspective. But Total actually has got a stronger track record of paying its dividend compared to BP and Shell, and hasn't cut its dividend in the last 20 years. So we're looking to use that stock selection to really have high degree of confidence in those high yielding names. But it's about balancing the quality and the total return objectives, but also making sure that we've got that dividend, and it's a resilient income that we think that we can deliver through the cycle.
Thank you. So I'd like to pick up on the quality aspects of the portfolio now, because it's something that you've touched on, and it's pretty interesting to get into actually how you define a quality stock. So you gave some really good qualitative examples there, but maybe if we look at the quantitative side of things now, when you're looking at companies identifying quality stocks, do you have any criteria, a stock screening selection that you implement?
We run, we do fundamental research on every company that we cover. So we are leveraging research. So Ben and I co-manage the portfolio together. We're leveraging research and insights from across our developed market equities team, where we have extensive coverage of developed market equities. So we've got about 9 portfolio managers who look at UK companies across large and small caps. We have a team of 10 sector analysts who cover global sectors. And we also have a European portfolio management team as well. And every company we invest in is covered by an individual at the firm. And part of that is the analyst will do a quality assessment of that, of the business that they're recommending. So there are 5 elements of quality which we'd look at. So the first would be industry. How attractive is the industry? Is it growing? Is it rational? How consolidated is it? We'd look at the moat and the business model of the company. So do they have a competitive advantage? Is it sustainable? How resilient are the earnings? You know, is it recurring revenue, sort of the revenue model of the business? And that will be sort of an important indicator of the overall quality of that company in terms of their ability to sustain that competitive advantage. We look at the financials. So there we're looking at the cash generation, the returns of the business, the balance sheet strength, in order to, you know, make sure that we're not taking on unnecessary risks within those businesses, and we're actually looking for opportunities for improving returns. And then the management. I mean, management's very important. We meet our businesses about twice a year, sometimes more. How strong is the management team? Are they able to navigate changing macroeconomic environment, or how well are they doing in terms of their capital allocation? So that's a lot of our time spent on that. And then finally, ESG and sustainability. Every company is assessed on how well they are managing the key environmental, social, governance risks facing them, and are they harnessing any opportunities? So those are the five criteria we look at. We will then rate the companies from 1 to 5 on those individual elements, and then give an overall quality rating to the business as well. And we're looking to have the portfolio positioned in higher quality businesses. So we would not invest in a company that we think has a low level of overall quality. So we have a threshold in place in terms of what we will and won't invest in from a quality perspective. And again, we're doing this because we think that quality is a factor which should provide resilience for the portfolio through tougher times, maybe that we're seeing at the moment. But also we think that the market generally underappreciates the sustainability of growth in high quality businesses. And so that's what we're looking to harness and assess when we're thinking about the valuation of the companies.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So we've the discussion so far has been very much stock specific and looking at how you identify quality companies. But I'd like to take a step back now, Rebecca, and look at the macro and get your thoughts on what's happening out there and really ask the question of how did you approach the volatility that we've seen recently in the wake of Donald Trump's tariff announcements and whether you were using that opportunity to pick up any stocks, and if so, which ones?
Yes, it has been a very eventful month of April. So a lot to digest for the market and for ourselves as well. In terms of the headlines around tariffs. So what have we been doing? A number of things. I suppose we're lucky that we can access our economist research. So we've been looking at the macroeconomic view, and we've been looking to then pair this with the bottom-up stock assessment of the impact of tariffs. So from a sort of top-down, our economists have been looking at the overall tariff levels and assessing the outcome of what that could mean for global economy. Their assessment is that it presents a shock to the US, which could be stagflationary. And they have downgraded their US and global growth forecasts this year on the back of the risks posed by tariffs. Another sort of data point would be looking at the risk of recession in the US. And I think there's certainly been an increase in that level of recession risk that we see out of the US from the uncertainty which is caused by the tariffs. On the UK front, actually, if we're looking sort of top down, given the UK is more services oriented, is less dependent on exports, actually, it should be relatively well positioned. And actually could benefit from some deflationary impacts from services and energy as well. So we think sort of on a relative basis, the UK looks okay. But what's more important to the UK economy, and I think what is more challenging really to assess, is what those second order impacts will be from the tariffs. So it's not the direct costs, but it's more what happens to the level of growth and how does that feed through to the portfolio. And then from a bottom-up perspective, we've been speaking to companies, we've been looking at earnings calls and for the companies we own, but also the wider sector. We've been debating the impact of tariffs as across the research team, thinking about what it means for our coverage in order to get that bottom up view. And I think, what's the actions and outputs from that analysis? I think the first point would be to say it's actually plays well into active management and stock picking, because the uncertainty that this event has created has meant that there are more opportunities for those who are sort of digging in the weeds in order to assess the impact, even though there's a high level of uncertainty. I think it does play into active management. And from a bottom-up analysis, when we look across the portfolio, there are a handful of companies which are impacted by those first-order effects. We think it's less than 10% of the capital, which could face potential tariff costs. But also those businesses should have an element of mitigation available to them. So a company like Diageo, which will in theory face tariffs from Mexico and from Canada, if those are imposed, the company has got a very strong portfolio of brands and so should have some ability to be able to price the tariff costs and pass that on. Another company that we own is Volvo Trucks, which is in a cyclical industry in terms of it being construction vehicles, and certainly concern around the cycle, you know, could pose a challenge for orders within the business. But Volvo makes its trucks in the US, whereas its peers make the majority of their trucks in Mexico. So actually, on a relative basis, there could be a market share opportunity for that business. So we've gone through the portfolio, we've done sort of the bottom-up work to assess where the risks are, but also to what extent the companies can mitigate and manage those risks. And then from that work, we've then sort of gone on to done some trading, but I'd say there's not been a huge level of portfolio turnover. There's been a lot of change, and a lot of the share price moves actually have subsequently unwound. So in the immediate aftermath, we took the opportunity to buy a number of businesses which had sold off that we thought were relatively immune to tariffs. So I've mentioned sort of UK being relatively well placed. So we topped up in holdings in Genuit, which is a UK building parts construction business, Taylor Wimpey, which is a UK house builder, NatWest, the retail bank, and M&G, which is an asset manager, which had all sold off. So we felt like the share price was overdone on those shares, and actually those businesses should be relatively well placed. And then we also took the opportunity to write a put over Diageo, which, as I mentioned, whilst it does face the US consumer, and there are kind of question marks about the health of the US consumer, it does have a very strong portfolio of brands, and the valuation has come back to a level where we would be happy to add capital to that. So we did write some options over that in order to reflect that conviction in the portfolio, and in order to make these trades, we did fund with some trims to AstraZeneca, Unilever, and Chesnara, which had held up, and we felt that it was an opportunity to sort of take some profits in those businesses during that period of volatility. But as I say, the shares have moved quite far, and so a number of those businesses have bounced back now, and they're trading higher than they were at the start of the month, for including NatWest. So it felt like a brief period, but I think that the underlying analysis which led to those trades is still correct, and we continue to look in the UK mid-cap space, for example, in our pipeline of new ideas.
Thank you. Fascinating. Really interesting point that you made as well, Rebecca, about the active approach to equities during volatility, and some of the disconnects that we saw on quality companies and what their underlying businesses were compared to the share prices during that period. So next question. I think this is pretty self-explanatory, but I am going to ask it because I think it would be good for listeners to get your perspective on it. When you're looking at the uncertainty that we have this year, we don't know what the impact of the trade tariffs are going to be because they're changing so quickly. But when you're looking at the uncertainty and what's happening out there, why would you say that Dunedin Income Growth is a good option to ride out any uncertainty that we see on the back of trade wars this year?
Yeah. Okay. I think there's probably three reasons. The first is the quality approach. I think now is a good time to be investing in quality because it's giving you exposure to businesses which should be able to navigate heightened uncertainty. These are companies which have got exposure to structural growth. They've got strong business models, robust financials, haven't got financial stress. And, during times of uncertainty, these become safe havens, these defensive businesses in general, are places where, you can have a higher degree of confidence in those businesses to pay their earnings and to pay their dividend. I think the quality approach, now is probably a time for it to be a tailwind to performance after, quality as a style has been a headwind to performance over the last few years, as has been more of a shift towards value. So I think quality, going forward, is a good place to be in this uncertain time. The second would be around the UK space. I mean, I think overall, any shift in sentiment towards the UK would be supportive. So, you know, we are mostly UK equities invested in. We have got 20% allocation to Europe. But, you know, if we go into the year, there was a high level of consent. There was a consensus view that really there was only one trade, and that was the US equities. And within US equities, it was a handful of stocks. And any shift in sentiment away from that US exceptionalism towards Europe and UK will be helpful for the UK equity market and the European equity market, and should be supportive to the valuations of the index. And we're overweight the mid cap index as well, which has rebounded in the last couple of days and weeks, but really has lagged the large cap index year to date, and it has over the last couple of years. And there's some great businesses in the UK mid cap index. It's about 20% of our capital invested. It's trading at 20-year historic low multiple versus the FTSE 100. And we see lots of opportunities for really resilient, innovative, quality businesses that are undervalued. I've mentioned a couple already, you know, sort of companies like Genuit. Another one would be Oxford Instruments. We've got some real estate businesses, Sirius Real Estate. I've mentioned Assura. I think that part of the market, sort of a flow of sentiment towards UK will be supportive for the shares, and also UK mid caps as well, I think, are a really compelling opportunity. And finally, I think the investment, if we were sort of just to take a step back and think about investment trust structure overall, you know, the support that you get from the structure in the trust's ability to pay a dividend and a resilient dividend when times are tough, I think that is helpful. So, as I mentioned, the trust has got a 43-year track record of growing or maintaining its dividend, and that's supported by revenue reserves and also capital reserves, which mean that even if we were to see a more negative outcome from a global macro perspective, the investment trust structure should mean that the underlying dividend paid to shareholders of Dunedin Income Growth should be resilient. So that certainly is a priority and of the board as well. So I think that's a helpful place to be when there is concern about the macro cycle.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to move on now, Rebecca, and discuss the sustainability and responsible investing policy, because it is something, you know, looking at materials that is pretty prevalent. But it is quite interesting to see, you know, companies such as Diageo in there, an alcohol company. So it'd be good if we could lift the lid on your approach and your criteria to responsible investing.
Yeah, so the trust introduced a sustainable and responsible investment approach in 2021. And this year we have been working to increase the level of disclosure on the trust relating to sustainability, because we've had regulation in the UK that's come in under SDR, which the trust is compliant with. So you can see more information on the website relating to that if you're interested. But the approach is threefold. So there are negative exclusions applied to the universe, which means that there are a number of business models, industries which are excluded from the approach. And this is about reducing the trust's exposure to high environmental and social risks. So it covers sectors like controversial weapons, tobacco production, coal product, thermal coal production, but also elements of utility generation, which with high carbon footprint. So there are a number of exclusions. They represent about 20 to 25% of the investable universe, and it does mean that there are certain sectors that the trust won't invest in. But I'd say that in itself is not a huge restriction, because the process is already looking for quality businesses. And so lots of the companies which were excluded for sustainability reasons would also not be acceptable for a quality perspective. I think quality overall is probably even more of a higher bar and actually more restrictive than sustainability when we're thinking about those elements of quality that we talked about before. So we don't sort of see it really as being particularly restrictive, the sustainability approach. But that's one element of it. And then the next element is about positives. So as part of our assessment of quality, we're looking at sustainability and ESG, and we're looking at risks, but we're also looking at opportunities. So this ties into some of those structural growth trends. So solutions businesses are businesses which are aligned to a sustainable theme. So if we think about a company like AstraZeneca, which is providing treatments for oncology and also cardiovascular health, these are long-term sustainable challenges which the company is looking to provide innovative solutions to, and so should support that the long-term growth prospects of the business. A company like Convatec have also mentioned they make products to help customers with chronic illnesses, whether it is treatments for sort of cuts, but wound care, but also ostomy care, continence care. And so those are long-term themes, which both address the sustainability challenge, but also sort of support the long-term growth prospects of the business. So it's about opportunities as well as exclusions. And then the third element of the approach is around engagement. So we meet the businesses that we invest in, but we also speak to different people in those companies, whether it's head of sustainability, head of supply chain sourcing, in order to get a better understanding about how those companies are managing those issues. And that can be really helpful just to sort of link it back to the financials of the company and the overall management. So yeah, there are exclusions, but that's just one of three elements of the sustainable investing approach which we take. You mentioned Diageo. I mean, alcohol as a negative screen doesn't come up very high when we speak to investors in terms of parts of the market they do and don't want to have investments in for a sustainable investor. So whereas tobacco is generally, there's general sort of consensus amongst sustainable investors, they don't want exposure to tobacco. It's less clear on alcohol, and that could change. We'll keep assessing it and speaking to shareholders and investors, but currently that is not a high priority for the sustainable investing market.
Thank you. That's a really fascinating insight, Rebecca. As the sustainable investing, responsible investing area evolves, it's really good to get your insight into your approach. So thank you so much for so far a very comprehensive breakdown of the investment trust. To finish off now, Rebecca, I want to take a look at the future and ask you what excites you the most about being a UK focused, I know there's some exposure to Europe within the trust, but a UK focused equity manager.
Well, UK equities have been unloved and underowned for a number of years, and there's been a lot sort of thrown at the UK market, and it has been a place where we've seen consistent outflows out of UK equities and towards global and the US. And I think if we get to a point where those outflows stop and if we start to see inflows into UK equities, it can be quite powerful given the starting valuation of the index. It's the discount that the UK market's trading versus its own history and versus other markets is compelling. But for the trust, on top of that, we've got a portfolio of very high quality companies, which is... the portfolio valuation is trading at a low premium to the underlying benchmark for that high quality portfolio. And then on top of that, we've got the shares are trading at a discount to NAV, 8% discount to NAV. So we sort of see it as a triple discount on the shares, which I think is an exciting opportunity. And then sort of the second point would be just to think about the companies in the portfolio. It's an active portfolio, but there are some really strong idiosyncratic ideas within the UK market and within the portfolio. It's not just about the UK economy. These are global businesses servicing different end markets. And so, if I was to give you one example, a company called Genus, which does gene editing for pigs and beef. Last week, there was an announcement that the FDA had approved a new drug, which is helping resist pigs from a particular disease called PRRS. And if that comes through over the next couple of years, then there's a material opportunity within those shares, which are not reflecting that pipeline of earnings which could come from that single drug opportunity. So, you know, I think looking for those idiosyncratic ideas, looking for value in the UK, actually we're seeing lots of opportunities, and it's an exciting time to be investing in the UK market.
Fantastic. Thank you. I did say that was the last question, but I do just have one more very quickly. You mentioned one of the factors that you saw as a reason to be excited about UK equities was a potential for inflows to pick up. You know, over the years, I've had numerous conversations with managers. That's always been a response. But what do you see as a catalyst to actually get those inflows moving into the UK?
Well, I think there are a couple. So sort of one would be if tariffs are implemented, and sort of obviously there's a huge degree of uncertainty as to what's going to happen with the reciprocal tariffs. But, you know, if there are reciprocal tariffs that they do come back, then the UK, given its economy and what's been said so far about the UK's 10% baseline tariffs, actually the UK should be relatively well placed. And so for investors looking for economies which are more sort of a safe haven in that trade storm, then actually this could be a time to be looking at the UK again. The second is that the interest rates in the UK are expected to fall, but they could fall at a faster pace than people expect because of macro uncertainty, but also you could start to see more deflation or a quicker ease of inflation as energy prices have come under pressure, and that could create an environment for the Bank of England to accelerate its pace of rate cutting. And I think that would be very supportive for the economy, but also for the market. And then sort of the third point is around flows, is that it doesn't need to be a huge pickup in flows, but sort of stopping the selling would be one helpful flow indicator for UK equities. And so that dynamic, a shift in that dynamic could be powerful.
Thank you very much. Just a note to listeners, do check out the notes to this podcast, because there'll be a link through to the Dunedin Income Growth Trust website. You'll be able to get all the information to do your own research, including the fact sheet. So do check out the notes to this podcast. Rebecca, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for your time.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.